That's right. Good afternoon. The Congressional Redistricting Subcommittee will come to order. Kyle, please call the roll.
Chair Saroy.
Here.
Vice Chair Tuck.
Here.
Ranking Member Skidmore.
Here.
Representatives Beltran.
Here.
Benjamin. Here. Brown. Brown. Fabricio. Fabricio. Fetterhoff.
Here.
Fisher.
Perfect time.
G. Lombardo.
Here.
Harding. Harding. Hunchowski.
Here.
Joseph.
Here.
Masullo.
Here.
Morales.
Present.
Perez excused. Plakin excused. Silvers excused. Toledo excused. Tribolsi.
Here.
Williamson.
Here.
Quorum is present, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Kyle. Members, a few reminders before we begin. Please silence all electronic devices, and if you wish to make public comment, please fill out a speaker form and turn it into the sergeant staff. Also, a reminder for our members and presenters, please ensure that you turn your microphone on when you are speaking and off when you are finished. Members, welcome back to our interim committee meetings. So far in this process, we have covered an introduction to redistricting concepts, reviewed our website and current public input opportunities, discussed our map drawing applications' advanced functionality, and how those tools can assist us in aligning our maps with our constitutional standards, as well as demonstrated some of the tangible examples of our constitutional standards within our currently enacted congressional maps. I explained during our first committee meeting how important a comprehensive educational effort is to understanding the full scope of redistricting. I hope you're coming to appreciate that this is not an easy task, nor will there be one clear-cut answer. One of the last pieces of educational information we need to cover as a committee is the legal aspect of redistricting, which includes applicable federal, state law, as well as case law related to this process, especially the Florida Supreme Court precedent that established following the that was established following the 2012 redistricting cycle. This will directly impact how we view and apply our Tier 1 and Tier 2 standards. For this redistricting cycle, the House has retained outside counsel to advise the chamber on state and federal law, as well as relevant court precedent. Today, for today's presentation, our committee will be hearing from Andy Bardos. Mr. Bardos has been with Gray Robinson since 2005 and was involved in the 2012 redistricting cycle, as well as having previously served as a special counsel in the Florida Senate. We're glad you're with us today, sir. Thank you. Members, I want to differentiate that today's council presentation is for our education on relevant redistricting law. It is not for discussing hypothetical scenarios or specific policy decisions that may come before our committee. As I've mentioned before, there is no correct map. When we begin reviewing district boundary lines, decisions will be weighed among one another with the goal of drawing a legally compliant map. As Mr. Bardos goes through his presentation, I encourage you to take notes of questions that you may have. Once the presentation is concluded, we will take questions from members on the content of the presentation, and then we'll move on to public comment. And with that, Mr. Bardos, welcome to the House Congressional Redistricting Committee, and you're recognized for your presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Andy Bardos. I'm an attorney with the Gray Robinson Law Firm. I'll be providing an overview today of the legal standards that apply to state legislative and congressional districts, with an emphasis, of course, on congressional districts. Given that this is a subcommittee for drawing congressional plans, the standards that apply to the two in the two contexts are very similar. I'll point out the differences, which are few, but otherwise, the standards will be similar. So, the standards come from a number of different sources. The United States Constitution imposes legal standards, as does the Federal Voting Rights Act, and now the state constitution, which in 2010 was amended to add a number of substantive legal standards that will guide our thought process in drawing new districts. I'll begin with the Federal Voting Rights Act, which was enacted in 1965 by Congress to enforce the 15th Amendment. The 15th Amendment guarantees that the right of citizens to vote will not be denied or abridged on account of race. and the Voting Rights Act was enacted to govern a number of different aspects of election law. Two provisions in particular are relevant to redistricting, and those are Section 2 and Section 5. Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act prohibits a state from imposing election laws that result in the denial or abridgment of the right to vote on account of race, color, or membership in a language minority group. That's very broad language, but the U.S. Supreme Court, in the context of redistricting, has refined that in a case called Thornburg versus Jingles and given definition to that legal standard. Jingles was decided in 1986, and this slide shows the criteria that the U.S. Supreme Court announced in the Jingles case. And these are the criteria that must be present for Section 2 to apply. And Section 2 applies to a particular region of the state where it might require the drawing of a minority opportunity district. The Jingles standard sets forth three preconditions. These three preconditions are quantifiable and objective, more so than the ultimate test, which is a totality of the circumstances analysis, which we'll discuss in a moment. The first three criteria are here numbered on this slide. And the general concept here is that if a minority population is sufficiently large that it could be the majority in a single member district, and it has voting preferences that are different from that of the majority of the electorate, so that the majority of the electorate would usually defeat the preferred candidates of the minority population, then the minority population might be entitled to a district that gives them a majority population status and therefore the ability to control the outcome of that election. The three criteria encompass those ideas. The first one is that the minority population must be sufficiently large and geographically compact to constitute a majority in a single member district. So this is the first standard that must be satisfied. So in a congressional district, for example, with an ideal population in excess of 700,000 people for total population, this would require a minority population that's relatively compact in excess of 300,000 people. Of course, for Section 2, we would use the voting age population only, not look at the total population, but that gives some idea of how large the population must be before Section 2 could even apply. Not only must the minority population be sufficiently large that it would constitute a majority of the voting age population, it must be geographically compact. Section 2 will never require the drawing of a district that is not compact. It doesn't require the combining of populations that are remote from each other into a single district that doesn't have a geographically compact shape. But where the minority population is large enough to be the majority of the voting age population in the district, and it is relatively compact, then we look at criteria 2 and 3, which encompass this idea of racially polarized voting. And racially polarized voting means that the minority population prefers different candidates from the majority population. And therefore, because the minority population is outnumbered, their preferred candidate will usually be defeated. And so in that situation where there's racially polarized voting, and yet the minority population could, depending on how the district is drawn, be a majority in that district, Section 2 might apply to require the drawing of a district that gives minority voters a majority in a district. But it only applies if this final criterion is satisfied, which we see on this slide. And this is less objective, it's less quantifiable. It's based on the totality of the circumstances. We must ask whether members of the minority group have less opportunity than other members of the electorate to participate in the political process and to elect representatives of their choice. And in Jingles, the court enumerated various considerations that inform that analysis. The courts will consider whether there are discriminatory election practices, whether there is racially polarized voting, whether there have been racial overtones in campaigns, whether there has been discrimination in other areas that affect the ability of a minority group to participate in the political process. And all of that is considered in totality to determine whether minority voters have the same opportunity to elect the candidates of their choice and to participate in the political process as the majority of the electorate. If not, and if the other criteria are satisfied, then the state is required to draw a district that provides minority voters with an opportunity to elect the candidate of their choice by making them a majority of the voting age population of that district. That was Section 2. The other provision of the Voting Rights Act that can be relevant to redistricting is Section 5. Section 5 is no longer effective, however. As of 2013, when the United States Supreme Court decided the Shelby County versus Holder decision, we will cover it, though, because the Florida Constitution has incorporated Section 5's principles into our state law. And so it continues to apply to Florida's redistricting plans through the Florida Constitution. When it was originally enacted, Section 5 was a temporary measure that was designed to cover select jurisdictions. And those jurisdictions were jurisdictions that, back in the 1960s and 1970s, had in place what are called by the Voting Rights Act tests or devices. And the best example of that would be a literacy test. And so these jurisdictions that had a test or device in place and also had relatively low rates of turnout or registration among minority voters were identified by Congress in the Voting Rights Act through a formula as being subject to Section 5. And so in Florida, five counties were identified as being subject to Section 5. But of course, if there was a state law, such as a redistricting plan, that would apply to those five counties, then that state law was also subject to Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act. And what that meant was that a voting law that applied to those five counties could not retrogress. And that means no backsliding, that minorities would not be in a worse position than they were in before that law was enacted. And in order to ensure that there would be no retrogression, the Voting Rights Act required election law changes to be submitted either to the United States Department of Justice or to the Federal District Court for the District of Columbia to be pre-approved before it could go into effect. And this was considered by the U.S. Supreme Court to be a very stringent remedy for a harm that was identified by Congress. And that's why in the Shelby County versus Holder case, the United States Supreme Court viewed Section 5 with some analytical rigor, and it determined that ultimately, because facts had changed since the 1960s and 70s, this coverage formula that determined which jurisdictions would be subject to Section 5 was outdated and could no longer be applied because it was based on data that was 40 or 50 years old. And so in Shelby County versus Holder, the United States Supreme Court invalidated that coverage formula, and now because there's no coverage formula, Section 5 doesn't apply anywhere. Congress could enact a new coverage formula that's based on current conditions, but it has not done that. We will see, though, that this anti-retrogression principle continues to apply in Florida through the Florida Constitution. Before we move into the Florida Constitution, we'll talk about two more concepts from federal law, both of which arise from the United States Constitution. The first is racial gerrymandering, and this slide references Miller versus Johnson, which is probably the leading case on racial gerrymandering, although the United States Supreme Court has considered a number of cases in this area. And this is an interpretation of the Equal Protection Clause of the United States Constitution. And the court has held that the Equal Protection Clause prohibits the consideration of race in redistricting as the predominant factor. In other words, race cannot be the predominant consideration in drawing district lines. It may be considered, and it may be a motive to enacting a district in a particular way, but it may not be predominant. And the court has explained that what that means is that traditional redistricting principles, such as compactness, may not be subordinated or made secondary to the consideration of race in redistricting. There is an exception to that the court has recognized, and that is if necessary to comply with the Voting Rights Act, the legislature may consider race and utilize race as the predominant consideration. The court has never explicitly decided this, but it has stated in a number of cases that it assumes as much. It assumes that compliance with the Voting Rights Act justifies the consideration of race as the predominant consideration in drawing districts. So to the extent that it's necessary in order to comply with Section 2 or Section 5, the legislature may consider race even as the predominant factor. Otherwise, race may be one of the considerations in the mix but cannot predominate over other traditional redistricting principles. The second concept, and it's a related one, is partisan gerrymandering. And partisan gerrymandering is also an interpretation of the Equal Protection Clause. And as of 2019, in the Rucho versus Common Cause decision, the United States Supreme Court has held that federal courts will not get involved in deciding partisan gerrymandering claims. This is relevant, however, to our state constitutional standard, which we'll discuss momentarily. In the federal courts have interpreted the United States Constitution not to prohibit at least some partisan gerrymandering. They have said that considering partisanship is permissible under the federal Constitution. The question was always whether it can go too far and how the courts would go about determining how much partisan consideration is too much in drawing a redistricting map. And in a number of decisions, the United States Supreme Court has deferred on that decision. And finally, in 2019, it decided that it has not identified a legal standard that it could consistently and reliably apply to determine when a redistricting plan goes too far in considering partisanship in drawing districts. And therefore, the court decided that partisan gerrymandering is not a claim that federal courts will consider. So we move now to the Florida Constitution. Article 3, Section 16 sets out certain parameters, but this is for state legislative districts rather than congressional. It is relevant in some ways to congressional in the sense that this dictates the timeline by which state legislative districts must be adopted. They must be adopted in the second year after each decennial census, and so that would be in 2022 in the regular session. And although the congressional redistricting plan is not bound by that same timeline, typically they have been developed and passed in tandem. So here we see the state constitutional standards that were adopted in 2010. They are found in Article 3, Sections 20 and 21 of the Florida Constitution. One of those sections governs state legislative redistricting, and the other governs congressional redistricting. But otherwise, the standards are the same. And they are separated into two tiers, Tier 1 and Tier 2. The Tier 1 standards prevail in case of conflict. To the extent that Tier 1 standards conflict with Tier 2 standards, Tier 1 standards have precedence. Within each tier, there is no order of priority. So within the tiers, Tier 1 standards, for example, must be balanced with each other. And likewise, within Tier 2, those standards must be balanced with each other. The fact that one is stated before the other, the order in which they are stated, does not establish an order of priority. And there are conflicts. There is tension between these standards. For example, sometimes avoiding diminishment in the ability of minority voters to represent their candidates of choice might require drawing a non-compact district. And so in that case, Tier 1 would prevail, and the legislature would be free to draw a non-compact district. Likewise, within Tier 2, there could be tension between the compactness standard and the requirement to utilize existing political and geographical boundaries where feasible. So, for example, a city or a county might not be compact. And so if the legislature wants to preserve that city or county or follow its boundaries, then it might not draw a district that would be as compact if it could ignore political and geographical boundaries. So those standards must be reconciled and balanced in the drawing of the map. Now we'll review some of the Florida Supreme Court's interpretations of these provisions. The first that we'll discuss is the Tier 1 standard that prohibits the drawing of districts with an intent to favor or disfavor a political party. This was a significant addition to the Florida Supreme Court, to the Florida Constitution in 2010. And the focus of this provision is intent. What matters here is whether the legislature is drawing districts with an intent to favor or disfavor a political party. The focus of this provision is not the effect of the map. There could be nonpartisan reasons why a map might favor one political party or another. The question is, what was the intent in drawing it? If the intent was to favor a political party or to disfavor a political party, then that map violates the standard. If that was not the intent, if that was simply an effect, if that was a political consequence, then it doesn't violate the standard. And every redistricting plan will have political effects. Every redistricting plan will have political ramifications. And that's why the Florida Supreme Court made clear that the focus of this provision is intent, as the language of the provision states. The court also made clear that there is no acceptable level of improper intent. It may not be considered, partisan considerations may not be considered and weighed in combination with other redistricting criteria. It simply must be excluded from the redistricting calculus altogether. The court made clear also that the legislature is not required to balance the map between the two political parties. As this slide states, the Florida Constitution does not require the affirmative creation of a fair plan, but rather a neutral one in which no improper intent was involved. So again, intent is the focus of this standard. If political intent is set aside, then this standard has been complied with. Likewise, with respect to incumbency, there may be no intent to favor or disfavor an incumbent. That's why the Florida Supreme Court said here that the inquiry for intent to favor or disfavor an incumbent focuses on various considerations. It would involve the shape of the district. The court will look at the shape of the district in assessing whether there was an intent to favor or disfavor an incumbent, and it will look at incumbent addresses relative to those district lines to determine whether a district appears to be intentionally taking in an incumbent's residence or excluding an incumbent from the district. Those are things that the court will consider as evidence in determining whether there was an improper intent. From the legislature's perspective in the process of passing that map, once again, this is essentially a negative standard. It tells you what may not be done, what may not be considered, and the legislature may not consider and draw maps with an intent to favor or disfavor an incumbent. Now we're moving into the provisions that are the analogs to the Voting Rights Act provisions. The Tier 1 standards include requirement that districts be drawn to provide racial and language minorities with an equal opportunity to participate in the political process. This is the Florida Constitution's equivalent to Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act, and it has been interpreted in the same way. So the Jingles standard that we discussed earlier with its three preconditions, and then ultimately the totality of the circumstances analysis would apply under the Florida Constitution as well. The second provision, this is the under the Florida Constitution, which relates to racial or language minorities, is the diminishment standard. This is the equivalent of the Section 5 prohibition on retrogression. Section 5, as we discussed, no longer applies, but under the state constitution, the legislature cannot draw districts that diminish the ability of minority voters to elect the candidates of their choice. Again, what this is focused on is the retrogression or a worsening of the position of racial or language minorities to elect the candidates of their choice. So the Florida Supreme Court stated in 2012 that the legislature cannot eliminate majority-minority districts or weaken other historically performing minority districts where doing so would actually diminish a minority group's ability to elect its preferred candidates. In assessing whether a new district diminishes the ability to elect a preferred candidate, we don't look simply to the voting age population of the district because it might not tell the full story as to whether minority voters in that district would have the ability to elect the candidates of their choice. So we have to perform what the court has referred to as a functional analysis. This requires a deeper dive into election data, including past election results, registration data, and turnout data within the districts that are under consideration. And that requires a comparison of the benchmark district, the former district that was in place, and the new district, to see whether the new district affords minority voters with an undiminished ability to elect the candidates of their choice. And in this analysis, the courts will be looking at whether the new map affords racial and language minorities at least the same number of districts in which they could elect the candidates of their choice as the prior map did. This slide sets forth the Tier 2 standards. The first is the districts must be as nearly equal in population as is practicable. This is the one person, one vote standard. In the context of congressional maps, this has been construed quite strictly. The United States Supreme Court, in interpreting the federal constitution, has said that this imposes a requirement of precise mathematical equality. And so state legislatures, when they redraw maps, typically will draw congressional districts to have a deviation of essentially one person, so that the district that is the largest district in terms of population will have one person more than the smallest district. In limited circumstances, the United States Supreme Court has recognized some leeway, but not much, and it requires a strong justification for every deviation from the one person, one vote standard. So precise mathematical equality has in practice been the standard that state legislatures have adhered to. The second Tier 2 requirement is that districts be compact. And this is basically a common sense measure. There's no bright line rule, but it begins with a visual analysis of the district. Does it have a regular shape, or is it bizarre or unusual in its shape? Does it have appendages? And so the visual examination is the first standard, and that's something that most people, when they look at a map, will easily see whether that's a district that looks reasonable or not. It's obviously, the compactness of a district is obviously affected by the geography of the state, and sometimes by the geography of Florida's counties, which are less compact than some counties in other states. So Florida's counties are somewhat irregular, and because of the third standard that we'll talk about in a moment, which is adhering to political boundaries, that might influence the compactness of some districts, as the geography of the state might. For example, in the Keys, you can't draw a circular or rectangular district in the Keys. So Florida as a state is not rectangular or square, and neither are its counties, so that will influence the compactness analysis. In addition to visual compactness, we look at mathematical measures, and there are a couple of mathematical measures of compactness that the Florida Supreme Court reviewed 10 years ago. These are aids to determining whether a district is compact, but visual compactness is the primary measure. The third standard under Tier 2 is that districts must, where feasible, utilize existing political and geographical boundaries. Political boundaries are city and county boundaries. So typically the legislature will try to keep as many cities whole and counties whole as possible and follow city and county boundaries. And it will, the other requirement, geographical boundaries, also requires the legislature, where feasible, to utilize easily ascertainable and commonly understood geographical boundaries. And those could be rivers or railways or interstates or state roads, things that voters can identify with and recognize so that the boundary isn't simply running somewhere that voters can't ascertain or identify. So these are all of the standards that the legislature must balance and implement in enacting any redistricting plan, and they all, in the context of the geography and the demography of the state, tend to come into some tension with each other. It's important to bear in mind, as the Florida Supreme Court recognized in 2012, that the legislature is not required to pass the best possible map or draw the most compact districts. It's simply required to pass a map that meets these constitutional thresholds, and there are a number of different configurations that could meet these minimum requirements, so the legislature doesn't have to find that one perfect map. And that covers the standards that I wanted to review today. That's an overview of the standards, and Mr. Chairman, I'd welcome any questions.
Thank you very much, Mr. Bartos, for your informative presentation. Members, there are two specific items that I'd like to address on the record before we take questions from committee members. The first issue is incumbencies. I want to state very clearly that we are not, and we will not, be using any incumbent or candidate addresses to produce these maps. The House took the same position last decade, and the Florida Supreme Court viewed that as a favorable step towards protecting against inadvertently favoring or disfavoring an incumbent, one of our Tier 1 standards. Members, I'd also like to point out candidly, as new district lines are workshopped and this process proceeds, there is a chance that any member may be paired with a fellow incumbent in a newly created district in order to create legally compliant boundaries. I know that this may be intimidating thought for members. However, that is part of our process. And as you bring comments to committee, please be mindful that I will not entertain any discussion about placing boundary lines in order to favor or disfavor an incumbent or potential challengers. The second item that I'd like to address is a point that Mr. Bartos touched on regarding the partisan makeup of the maps that will come before our committee. While external third-party groups seemingly prioritize the Republican-Democratic split over the legal compliance of our boundary lines, that is not what we as legislators are charged to do. Outside of using the functional analysis to ensure our racial and language minority groups can elect a candidate of their choice, a Tier 1 standard, I want to be clear that staff nor this subcommittee will be reviewing the overall partisan split of a map at any stage of this process to help ensure that we are not intentionally favoring or disfavoring a political party or incumbent. Chair Leek was clear yesterday in the full redistricting committee that they will also not be looking at a partisan split. Additionally, I would encourage you not to engage in any planned or unplanned conversations regarding such a topic, as it may lend itself toward a violation of Tier 1 standards as interpreted by the Florida Supreme Court. Now I'll open up to questions of Mr. Bartos for committee members. I'd like to remind you to please address your questions to the chair. I will ask for one question to be submitted at a time, and then I'll recognize Mr. Bartos to provide an answer, and we'll deal with any follow-up questions as they may arise. Representative Benjamin, you're recognized for a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question goes to intent. I noticed that there was some guidance in case law with regards to intent as relates to the incumbent, as to what the court looks to determine what the intent was. But I didn't see that in the what you provided for intent to favor or disfavor a political party. So is there anything that you've read or information that you have as to what are some of the things that the court looks for to determine what the intent was?
Mr. Bartos, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. That's a very good question. So when assessing the intent to favor or disfavor a political party, the court will review a number of considerations. Obviously, if there are statements on the record saying that we're favoring or disfavoring a political party, that would be direct evidence and the most informative evidence, but the court will also look at objective factors in the map to attempt to determine whether there was an intent to favor or disfavor a political party. One of those is how closely is the legislature following the Tier 2 standards, compactness and political boundaries and geographical boundaries. Those standards, among other things, are designed to limit the ability to favor or disfavor a political party or an incumbent. And so the courts will look at that. And if the districts are compact, if they faithfully follow political and geographical boundaries, then that weighs against a finding that there was an improper intent. The courts will look at the shape of the district. It will look at whether the district, it will look at the district population and the demography of the district relative to the shape of the district. And it will look at whether there have been interactions with outside actors who might have a vested political interest in the process. That was something that was part of the redistricting litigation after the last cycle. It will look at the demographics of the district and the overall political composition of the map. So the overall political composition of the map, I think by itself, the court expressed won't be enough because the court recognizes that there might be factors such as drawing districts for that protect the ability of minority voters to elect the candidates of their choice, or concentrations of certain voters of one political party in, say, urban areas at high rates that will affect the political composition of the map. So the court will look at everything in totality to determine whether there was an improper intent. And so those are some of the considerations that the court will look at.
Thank you. Representative Beltran, you're recognized for a question.
Thank you, Chairman, and thank you, sir, for your good presentation. I guess I'm the only legislator from Hillsborough, so I'm going to ask this question because my county has been listed on page 7 of the presentation. How on earth did Hillsborough County get singled out? I've wondered this for a number of years because I'm familiar with the VRA, but I wasn't able to determine historically. How did we get singled out? And then if you can just confirm for me that Shelby County versus Holder held that Hillsborough County is no longer singled out. And I guess hopefully there's no counties in Florida that there's been a finding, a congressional finding. But if you could just assure me that we're in good standing now and tell me how we got that there in the first place, please.
You're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I assume by singled out, you're referring to being one of the five counties that was identified for coverage under Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act. So in the 1970s, Congress amended the Voting Rights Act, and it added a provision to the Voting Rights Act that said that any jurisdiction, any county in the United States that as of 1972 had a test or device in place, and there's language in the Voting Rights Act that defines that, and that had certain registration rates or turnout rates among minority voters that were considered to be low, then those jurisdictions would be subject to Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act. So it goes back to 1972, and it's based on data from 1972 and election practices from 1972. That was never updated. That's why Shelby County versus Holder invalidated the coverage formula. And yes, you're correct. At this point, because of Shelby County versus Holder, neither Hillsborough County nor the other five counties that were originally covered, nor any other county in Florida is covered. And therefore, Section 5 doesn't uniquely apply to any of those counties. The diminishment standard does, however, apply to all counties in Florida under the state constitutional provision that we discussed.
Thank you. Representative Masullo, you're recognized for a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for your presentation, sir. You know, in an ideal world, we would have blended population where minorities don't exist. Obviously, we deal with them today. It's unfortunate that we have to in certain ways. But how do you define a minority population besides a consolidated area?
You're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So there's not a definition, but typically the minority populations that would typically be large enough to constitute a majority in a district or a population that would have the ability to elect, whether or not they're a majority in a district, would be African-American voters and Hispanic voters. And we use that data from the census, decennial census that identified individuals by race and by ethnicity in the case of Hispanic voters. And so we look at populations according to African-American and Hispanic.
One follow-up, Representative Masullo.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In the last census, have you found that there's been less indication of race on the actual questionnaire as there had been in the past?
I'm gonna interject there. I don't know that our speaker would be in the position to be able to provide an answer or any insight on that question.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions? Representative Beltran?
Thank you, Chairman. Thank you for your previous answer, sir. I just got one more question, which is from page 12 of your presentation, and this is the Tier 2 standard. It says districts shall, where feasible, utilize existing political and geographical boundaries. Does that essentially create a presumption subject to the other Tier 1 and Tier 2 standards that you don't cross county lines unless you have to? Is that a fair statement of the law, in your opinion?
You're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So it can be viewed as a requirement both to preserve intact a county, but also to follow the county boundary with the district boundary. So it can be viewed in different ways. During the last round of litigation, the courts would frequently look at how many counties have been split and how many times a county has been split. Those are considerations that go into that. But it can also be the use of an existing county boundary as the district boundary, following the county line itself, can be a justification for putting a district boundary in a particular place.
Thank you. Representative Fisher, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This question really came up in part because of your answer to Representative Masullo's question about minorities. My wife is originally from Singapore. My kids are Asian. You mentioned that only two minority groups there are considered. And I think last night we saw the first Asian American mayor elected in Boston and Cincinnati, and I know that we have a growing AAPI population in Florida. Why are only two subgroups considered?
Other groups could be considered. I'm simply saying that as
I'm sorry. I think, again, that would require our presenter to offer speculation on the way that the process is conducted in terms of the census and the data that's collected. I don't know that he's able to address that for us. But if you'd like to take a stab at it, you're more than welcome.
Yeah. I was just commenting on the numbers in Florida. It's the populations that are large enough, say 300,000 people, to be close to a majority in a congressional district in concentrations to draw a district will typically be African American and Hispanic populations.
Follow up?
So there's nothing in law or in court precedents that require it to just be two. That's just, you're just stating that that's kind of historically what's been considered and that others can be considered.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. That's correct. I was commenting on simply the numbers in Florida and the concentrations of population in geographical areas.
Thank you very much. Representative Joseph, recognized for a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I actually have three questions.
Let's take them one at a time, please.
All right, perfect. So just piggybacking off of the questions that were raised about other ethnic groups, when we're looking at minority populations, you mentioned in your presentation reference to language minorities, et cetera. Within Florida, the two largest immigrant populations are Cubans and then Haitians. So Haitians are usually classified under the African American whatever. How are they considered in this process as we're evaluating the redistricting?
You're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So the Florida Supreme Court didn't say very much about language minorities during the last process, so we don't have an interpretation of that. The Federal Voting Rights Act provides a definition of language minorities, but it's unclear whether the Florida Constitution will follow that same definition. To the extent that there is overlap with racial groups, as, for example, African-American groups, that data is in is available and is being used for drawing districts. Again, also the requirement, simply as a matter of numbers, you would have to have a population that's sufficiently large to be able to control the result of an election. So all of those are factors. But beyond that, the Florida Supreme Court hasn't elaborated on that standard in the way that it has on some of the others.
Recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The next question is, you made reference to one of the lessons learned from the prior litigation from our most recent census attempt. What other top line points would you want to make sure that this committee is aware of with respect to lessons learned from last time with redistricting post-litigation that we should avoid going forward this time?
I'm going to interject there. That I think that would ask for speculation on the part of our speaker, and I think that question is out of order.
Well, if I may, I'm not actually asking for speculation. I'm not asking, so to the extent that I would be, here's one way that you could look at it as speculation. So I'm not asking you to identify, let's say there were a list of five to tell me which two you think, but legally, what are some lessons that we need to know with respect to what came out of the last litigation for the purpose of this committee? I don't know if you still consider that speculation. I don't think it is, but you let me know. To the extent it wasn't already included in your presentation.
I think if the speaker would like to cover, Mr. Bartos, if you'd like to cover the mechanics of the decisions or opinions that the court offered, I think that would be fine, but I would caution against any speculation.
Yeah, I'm explicitly in my question not asking for speculation. I'm asking for actual law that the committee should be aware of.
Yeah, that's a very big question. We had about 6 years of litigation coming out of the last cycle. So I think the presentation has covered the high points. I think those are the legal standards. There's a lot of nuance in redistricting for each one of those standards. So I'm not sure where I would start with that. I think the high points are covered in the presentation, though.
Thank you.
Your third question?
And the third question is, so our chair sometimes makes reference to an eyeball test, and I'm wondering if that is the equivalent to, I think, what you called the visual test as being the primary test for geographic compactness. Is that the
You're
same?
Recognized.
Thank you. Yes, it's been called the eyeball test. It's been called the interocular test or the visual examination. So you know when you see it.
That was all.
I'm
going to
stick with eyeball. I'm going to stick with eyeball test. Did you have any further questions, Representative?
Sneak one more in. So you don't need to answer it now, but to the extent that there was anything that you think would be particularly pertinent in terms of lessons learned from the prior litigation that was not covered in your presentation, and we don't need to do this for the committee, but if there are any specific cases that you think we need to be aware of, I would love to see those. That was it.
Thank you.
Representative Skidmore for a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The question is not for the presenter, but for you, if now is the appropriate time.
Certainly.
Thank you so much. So we are speaking specifically on just the legal issues of the redistricting process. So my question is, at what point do we begin talking about the policies that we will apply as a committee toward the map-making process?
Thank you very much for that question. You know, I think that we have, as a committee, we have approached this project in several stages. As we have talked about repeatedly, it's necessary for this committee to have the foundational knowledge for us to be able to move forward, to understand the constitutional framework, to understand the applicable state and federal law. Today's presentation is a continuation of that process. And I think moving forward, now that we've been able to complete that, near completion of that educational process, you know, we're going to start turning our attention toward the task at hand. I cannot offer anything specific today related to what our schedule looks like moving forward, given special session. But as the committee members are aware, the Constitution requires that we complete this process during our legislative session, which begins on January 11th. So that is, I hope, a sufficient answer to your question. Members, thank you very much. I'm sorry. Are there any other questions from committee members? I want to thank you all for your questions, and now we will open it up to public comments. Do we have any public comment cards? Seeing no comment cards filed, once again, I want to thank you all for your time this afternoon. Mr. Bartos, I want to thank you for your presentation and for being here today. Members, if you have any follow-up questions for Mr. Bartos, please feel free to submit those to committee staff, and we'll work to get your questions answered. At our next meeting, we will keep the committee updated on our authorized dates and times as we find out more details about special session and any impacts that it may have to our schedule moving forward. Thank you, members. That concludes our committee meeting for today. Vice Chair Tuck moves that we adjourn. Hearing no objection, we are adjourned.